From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Trump, back in the U.S. from his summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, tweeted, "Everyone can now feel much safer than the day I took office. There is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea." But while applauding the meeting, even some ardent Trump supporters are worried that there are no details, that Trump blindsided allies and gave up too much with off-the-cuff remarks. The state-owned press in North Korea isn't even mentioning denuclearization, but is crowing about Trump's suspension of military exercises with the South.
Here in the U.S., South Carolina Congressman and Trump critic Mark Sanford is now the second House Republican to lose a primary this season. Last night, in her victory speech, his opponent Katie Arrington told supporters, "We are the party of President Donald J. Trump." Let's bring in our political strategist. Today, it's Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy and Robin. How are you?
Good.
Good. And Jamal, let me start with you. The North Korea summit. Do you think the president should be congratulated for making this summit happen?
I wanted to make a joke about feeling safer, but this isn't really the time for jokes. I think the president went to South Korea and really, frankly, was an easy first date. He kind of gave away a lot to the North Koreans before really getting anything in return that was verifiable or any way that we could check it. And he's left for the Democrats a wide open lane to sort of adopt the party of Reagan lines about trusting but verifying first. The president was so effusive about the leader of North Korea that he really opened himself up to any criticism if this thing doesn't work out, which history would say it won't.
It won't. Well, Alice Stewart, how about that? In a week where Trump bashed allies like Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and hit them with tariffs, he praised Kim Jong-un, a brutal dictator. Let's listen.
Well, he is very talented. Anybody that takes over a situation like he did at 26 years of age and is able to run it and run it tough. I don't say he was nice or I don't say anything about it. He ran it. Very few people at that age, you can take one out of 10,000 probably couldn't do it.
Boy, Alice, I mean, people are having a field day with that. You know, you can do it if you jail people and put them in gulags and murder people. That's one way that Kim Jong-un is doing it at that age. Look, Fox News is celebrating this meeting, but even ardent Republicans, backers of Trump, have been hesitant. What would you advise them?
I would advise them to let's be cautiously optimistic and emphasis on the caution. And look, I would never use the word talented to describe a brutal dictator. However, this is President Trump, and this is his way of beginning the negotiating process. And if the goal overall for the United States and the world is the complete denuclearization of North Korea and the Korean Peninsula, then Kim Jong-un holds the key to that. And in order for us to achieve that goal, we have to get through to him and we have to work with him. And the key is taking that first step. I commend the president for taking this first step, but we have a long way to go. And I do think Secretary Pompeo has a lot of work ahead of him in regard to making sure that our definition of denuclearization is the same as theirs. And he has been adamant on the three key components for that to be successful is complete, verifiable, and irreversible. And unless we have that, we have no deal. And I think the president should completely walk away.
Robin and Jeremy, I do have to say, it is incredibly rich for me, though, to watch President Trump and the people who support President Trump and his position here to show so much openness and willingness to compromise and find a way out of this. When President Obama did this with Iran, you would have thought that he had gone to Iran and offered them the, you know, crown jewels of the United States. He didn't. And I think we just have to be cautious about how much Republicans are falling in line over this when it's clear North Korea may be setting us up for a trial.
Well, and I have to say that if it were President Obama doing this meeting with Kim, I can't imagine that Donald Trump would not be attacking Obama for doing exactly what he just did.
He did when he said, once I'd meet with anybody, Obama said, well, I'd meet with anybody if I thought I could get peace, and he was attacked. But
sure, and he said he would do so without preconditions, which is virtually what the president Trump has done. But that being said, we're in a different time, and let's just say we will all wait, as the president says, We'll see what happens.
Okay. There were primaries in five states yesterday. And in South Carolina, voters told conservative Republican Congressman and former Governor Mark Sanford, who is, of course, famous for saying he was hiking the Appalachian Trail when, in fact, he was meeting his mistress in Argentina, they knocked him out. He conceded defeat last night to an opponent who claimed he wasn't loyal enough to Trump and his agenda.
It may have cost me an election in this case, but I stand by every one of those decisions to disagree with the president because I didn't think it, at the end of the day, was either concurrent with the promises I made when I first ran for office or the voices of the very people, the first district that I represent.
Jamal, what do you make of this? Is this just a case of loyalty to Trump is what matters most?
Yes. That's exactly what's happening here. I think the Republicans can no longer be considered the conservative party in the United States. They are now the Trumpist party. And that means they own all of what Donald Trump is for, including thinking that white nationalists are very fine people and that Mexicans are rapists and that the prime minister of Canada is a backstabber. All of those things are what the Republican Party now stand with. And I think that is going to do them great harm, both in the upcoming elections and in 2020.
But if you were, hang on a second. If you were a Democrat, though, Jamal, would you rather be running against a really pro-Trump Republican or somebody who's critical of him?
It is helpful for Democrats to run against pro-Trump Republicans because it's easier to draw the contrast. Okay. But it is not good for the country for that to be the case. We need two parties that both stand up for fundamental American values of freedom and opportunity, not one that is aligned with an authoritarian and the other one that is trying to stand up for
America. Alice, get in there.
Sure. I take exception to painting all Republicans with that same brush that you just painted us with. Because if you remember, Jamal, this week when the president and Peter Navarro, as well as others in the administration, came out so vocally against the Canadian prime minister, Senator McCain said, despite what others are saying, Americans stand with you, Canada. And there are many, many Republicans who do want to make sure that our allies understand that we are on their side. And this is something that we need to make sure and convey, not just as a party, but as a country. Well, and the actions of a few and the words of a few don't speak for all Republicans and certainly not all Americans.
But, Alice, you know that so many Republicans are painting John McCain as an outlier, or we need to go there, someone who's going to die soon and doesn't count anyway. I mean, that was even said about him. But
in a White House meeting.
In a White House meeting.
That wasn't said somewhere randomly.
But
it was
a
White House meeting.
But wait, I know, Alice, you might want to point out that the far-right Corey Stewart in the Virginia Senate primary was backed by many Republicans to go up against Senator Tim Kaine in the fall. He's a supporter of Confederate symbols, and the Republican Party may not support him. So there are some lines you can't cross.
Well, specifically, we're talking about the Republican National Senatorial Committee and the head of the organization, Senator Cory Gardner. He has been quite vocal with where he stands on this, and he has said he will not endorse Corey Stewart, nor will he provide funding for that race. Their money is much better spent elsewhere. And keep in mind, it was recently where Corey Stewart went over to the NRSC office and spoke ill will of them and virtually said, I don't want your help. I don't want your endorsement. So he's not going to get it, and in a large part because of those views that he has held that do not represent and reflect the Republican values with regard to his position on the Confederate flag and other issues.
What's curious about this to me is that all the people who are standing up that Alice rightly points out are people who are part of the national Republican leadership, some of whom are no longer going to be back in Congress, like Senator Corker or Senator Flake. But the people in the Republican Party, the voters in the Republican Party, are not aligning with the people who are trying to be critical and stand up for these values. The voters are saying Donald Trump is the litmus test. Everything else can fall away.
Okay, let's talk about the Democrats finally here. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer began his news conference yesterday saying that while a lot of focus is on North Korea right now, he said Democrats will have a singular focus through the summer, health care.
If you ask the American people, the number one issue they care about, it's health care, not anything else. And we are not going to get diverted. So many millions of American families will pay more in premium increases than any tax break they will get.
Jamal, explain this. Why health care as the focus?
I think Senator Schumer said it the way people read it, which is that if you do polls of voters tell you that health care is a problem. I mean, you look at what the president and his allies have been doing, which is to undermine Obamacare, which is causing disruptions in the marketplace. That is what the Democrats are going to run on. I think they should also be talking about holding President Trump accountable, and they should be talking about standing up for American values that make sure we're not separating mothers and children at the border, which is not something anybody, I think, really supports in the country.
Jamal, we only got a minute left, and I'm going to give it to you, and you're probably not going to be happy, but should former President Bill Clinton get off the stage? He was asked for the second time. He's on a book tour. He was asked about, sexual harassment and whether it's changed since Democrat Al Franken resigned over that, and Bill Clinton didn't after a sexual encounter. He seemed to step in it again. People can Google it. But should he perhaps just exit stage left for a while? What would you advise?
He's going to have to make that decision for himself. But here's the reality. He has got to come up with a way to talk about this that acknowledges the pain that he caused and the distance that we've traveled since his troubles back in the 1990s, because we've all now come to grips with the fact that so many of us men did not handle these things the right way over time.
It's Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons and Republican strategist Alice Stewart. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You may know there are religious courts. The Catholic Church has about 200 tribunals handling things like marriage annulments. The Muslim faith has courts that take on marital and other disputes. Today, a story about religious courts in the ultra-Orthodox Hasidic community. Chavi Weisberger grew up in one such Jewish community in Monsey, New York, in a family of revered rabbis isolated from American culture. When she and her husband divorced in 2008, the community's religious courts awarded Chavi custody of her three young children. But then her neighbors alerted the community her daughters occasionally wore pants or went to secular street festivals. Chavi realized she was a lesbian. The ex-husband took her to a civil traditional court in Brooklyn, which gave the children to him, ruling Chavi violated the contract of her religious court. Let's find out more. Chavi Weisberger joins us from NPR New York. Welcome.
Hi.
And you now work at Footsteps, which is a not-for-profit that provides counseling and social services for people making maybe the same transition you did out of an ultra-Orthodox faith. And so we want to bring in Lonnie Santo, who's executive director of Footsteps. Lonnie, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
And Chavi, help us understand your story. Again, you and your husband divorced. Things were going, fine. You had custody of your children. And then what? You started seeing more of the outside world. How protected had you been from the outside world?
I would say I was very protected. I didn't have a lot of understanding of larger ideas of how people lived. I didn't have access to education past my high school education, which was in an all-girls, ultra-Orthodox school. My exposure to secular ideas and people was very, very limited.
And you start to explore your own sexuality and realize you're a lesbian. What did you think when you also began to realize that neighbors were, in effect, turning you in?
Yes. I think a big part of the process for me was very internal. It was me starting to question if I was going to live a life that was honest and raise my children according to the values that I really believed in, then how would I do that in a way that I can live fully and honestly and was protective of my relationship with my children.
Yeah.
And eventually that started expressing itself externally. And that's when, neighbors in the community started having strong reactions.
Well, so you had gone to an Orthodox Jewish court to get the divorce agreement, and you'd signed a contract agreeing to practice your faith. This often happens. Many people don't know that these contracts that are written and agreed to in religious courts often end up in secular courts when someone feels that someone else has broken the contract. What happened in that secular court?
The original agreement that I signed in the Bet Din, which is the Jewish court of law, is seen as a negotiation or an arbitration agreement, and then was just presented in front of a judge and signed. And that's why it had such legal binding later when my ex-husband took me back to court to fight for custody of our children.
Okay, so the court had recognized it as a legal document. And what kind of defense could you make? Because hadn't you broken that legal document?
Yes, and that's why it was such a difficult case. Ultimately, best interest of the children has to override any pre-existing agreement. Since I was the children's primary caretaker all these years, and the children were comfortable with the lifestyle changes that were slowly happening for us as a family, it made sense that the children should be allowed to continue in that vein.
That was your defense, but that judge in that secular court turned you down and took the children away and gave them to the father. And I want to bring in Lonnie. Lonnie, how often does this happen that women or men have to go before these courts because they are moving away from their faith?
We see this happening in almost every case of individuals who are choosing to leave, especially Hasidic communities. There's almost always a contested divorce. And I think part of what's important to understand is that people are signing things that are not explained to them. Mm-hmm. They don't have counsel on the Beis Din. There might be a room full of rabbis with long beards, and for a woman especially, an intense power imbalance there. But for both men and women, they're told, just sign this and you'll be free of a marriage that's not working out for you. They don't know what they're signing.
Right, because the secular courts feel that, you know, they're first and foremost, they have to uphold a legal contract. And even in the case of Chavi Weisberger, if I understand correctly, your ex-husband was not paying child support, had several additional children, was not seeing your children with him very often. He still got the custody because you were seen to have broken the contract. And it's kind of an odd thing to picture, but Lonnie, do I understand that when these get to secular courts, very often these secular judges, or judges who are supposed to be, you know, secular, are asking the women questions about, you know, things they might be doing at home with their children? You know, in one report, a woman was asked, those fuzzy socks that you got, is that about Christmas, which would be violating your faith, or were they just fuzzy socks?
Right. And in that case, they were snowmen on socks. Yes, judges will ask whichever partner or spouse seems to be becoming less religious. And time again, the argument of best interest of the child as interpreted as maintain the status quo in their life is what's being upheld above all else, as opposed to seeing that as one of a number of different factors, including who the primary caretaker of the children has been, including the right of a child to have a relationship with both parents and the right of a parent to have a relationship with their children, no matter their religious identity. And I think in a lot of the cases that we're seeing, judges are favoring issues of freedom of religion, and they're also not necessarily looking at a First Amendment issue of freedom from religion.
Well, and others have said that one of the reasons for this is that some of these judges are elected, and these are areas that have large populations of ultra-Orthodox Jews, especially Brooklyn or Rockland County. Javi, can you see that in this case, if a child is in an ultra-Orthodox school or an ultra-Orthodox home, let's say half the time with their father, you know, they might be shunned if people know that their mother is a lesbian, or it might be too confusing to go from a home in which, you know, little girls aren't allowed to wear pants to yours, where maybe you would allow them? The community might feel that that is too disruptive for a child.
I think you bring up an excellent question. And while I do agree with you that we try to minimize stress and trauma from children's lives and keep things as stable as possible, in an ideal world, people wouldn't be married off at a really young age to someone they don't know before they have a chance to really explore who they are and how they want to raise their children and what their whole futures are going to look like. And so ideally, we wouldn't be in this position where children are now being raised by parents who have opposing values and lifestyles. But once we're at this place and there are children involved, ideally the courts should support navigating a way to support children to be living with both of their parents in their lives in as meaningful a way as possible. And children are smart and they're resilient, and they're really capable of understanding these nuances of who their parents are.
Well, and we should tell the end of the story, which is that another court overturned the first secular court's decision that the children should be taken away and restored full custody to you. And I just, Lonnie, talk about the two worlds, because at Footsteps, when men and women come to you for help, you know, leaving the ultra-Orthodox faith, you say they are exactly like immigrants.
Our members are immigrants into a country that they're citizens in. So while they might have grown up in Brooklyn or in Rockland County or somewhere in New Jersey, they have no access and exposure to how secular society functions. Even more than immigrants, they're incredibly socially isolated. When an immigrant comes to this country, they're not shunned by their family. Mm. But when an individual chooses to build a new way of life that's not necessarily in line with the values that they were raised in an ultra-Orthodox setting, they're often shunned by their families and their friends. And so their entire social and emotional support network really falls out from under them. And then on top of that, you have a lot of issues that are very akin to immigrant issues, such as access to English, job and career readiness, and building out those professional networks. And then even more so when you have parents, individuals who are parents themselves, you have a whole other set of issues.
Well, there are some poignant books and documentaries on this. One of Us, the Netflix documentary, Shulam Dean's All Who Go Do Not Return, another one. Javi, did this happen to you?
Yes. When I initially started making changes in my lifestyle, I lost my job that I had in the community. I lost the support of my family and friends. And I really felt like I had to start all over.
And how's it going? I mean, because we read this powerful line that this is a small community, a patriarchal community. I'm speaking of the Orthodox Hasidic community. Every child is considered as a Jewish soul that cannot be lost. Are you being made to feel that your children are lost?
I try very hard to shut out the voices of people who are not supporting me and my children in the journey of living a rich and full life. I can't say that that affects our day-to-day experience.
That's Javi Weisberger. She left the ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Jewish life and lost her three children through first a religious court, then a secular court, and regained them back. Lonnie Santo is executive director of Footsteps, a not-for-profit that provides social services for people leaving the ultra-Orthodox life. Javi was one of them. Now she works there. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
And your thoughts are welcome. As we said at the outset, other churches, the Catholic Church, the Muslim faith, have religious courts. Your thoughts welcome, hereandnow.org.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
American wine producers are big competitors in the global wine market, but the competitors occasionally work together. Did you know Midwestern grapes once helped save European wine? And as Laura Ziegler from Harvest Public Media reports, a vineyard outside of Weston, Missouri is trying to find and preserve those forgotten grapes.
The only way to start a story about wine is with a tasting, right?
I've always wanted to see a radio wine tasting, so...
That's Jerry Eisterhold, pouring wine in the tasting room of Fox Vineyard, where for the last 20 years he's been experimenting with grapes no one's been making wine from for a century and a half. Eisterhold grew up near Herman, Missouri, dubbed the Rhineland because of the influence of German immigrants. He's been interested in wine ever since.
This is a grape called Wetumpka.
Wetumpka.
Yes.
Eisterhold says the Wetumpka, a grape native to the region, can be hard to deal with. It immediately drops to the ground when it's ripe. The grapes, when pressed, are mostly pulp. In spite of these challenges, Eisterhold gets a kick out of making wine no one's ever tasted. Nationally known wine expert Doug Frost joins us for the tasting. Frost says the best wines say something about the soil, the climate, even the culture of where the grapes are grown.
so that when you taste a wine, you actually can say to yourself, you know, I can't taste this any place except there's this one place north of Kansas City that has this grape growing there, and it tastes just like this one. That uniqueness is what you hope for.
And that's just what Eisterholt is going for. A rare book collector, he pulls a worn volume from his shelf. It's Foundations of American Grape Culture by 19th century horticulturalist Thomas Volney Munson. The book is Munson's account of his work with indigenous American grapes. The Illinois-born botanist realized Midwestern varieties were hardier than cultured varieties. He spent his life collecting those grapes throughout the Midwest, Nebraska, Missouri, Arkansas, and North Texas, where he settled. His research was internationally recognized. When a deadly aphid began to decimate European vineyards in the late 19th century, growers asked Munson to send them some of his pest-resistant rootstock. It saved the European wine industry. Eisterholt has found Munson's abandoned vineyards in Texas. He's tagged pages of his book with illustrations of vines he wants cuttings of. It's a slow business.
You get half of them, and then you try to root them, and then half of them root. And so it has taken about 15 years to simply get the vines that I have out there.
Once the vines bear fruit, every iteration of wine takes a year to turn around. But Clark Smith, who Eisterholt has brought on as a consultant, says some of these grapes are really good and important to preserve.
Imagine if nobody knew about Mozart, and then all of a sudden somebody dug up his work and said, well, you know, this guy wrote some pretty good stuff. It's like that.
The sliding glass doors from Eisterholt's tasting room give way to a balcony overlooking 6 rolling acres of still naked vines. Below us, a worker is shoveling soil from the concrete patio into beds where cuttings for next year's crop will start. Eisterholt's labeled his wine Terra Vox, or Voice of the Land. He believes it captures the essence of Munson's work.
You know, he had the idea that agriculture and the plants and animals that we deal with are not fixed things, that they needed to evolve. So all of this is trying to sort of pick up on the wave that he started.
And show people Missouri wine can rival any in the world. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Ziegler.
In the West African nation of Cameroon, tensions between the minority English speakers and the French-speaking government have escalated. Thousands of Anglophone lawyers, teachers, and students in English-speaking cities in the west of the country have taken to the streets to demand more political rights and power for English-speaking regions. Amnesty International just issued a report saying the government has been torturing and attacking the protesters and that there have been unlawful killings and destruction of property. The protests began in 2016 and continue into this week. Agbo Kongo is a human rights lawyer who heads the NGO Center for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa. He's also Anglophone. He joins us via Skype from Boya in Cameroon. Welcome. And it may be surprising to some people when they hear about this, it's not a religious fight. This is a fight over people who speak different languages, English and French.
Well, it would be very simplistic to say it's just a fight about people who speak English and French. I think it has its own historical background. It's not only the speaking of English and French, but I think it's a cultural issue. It is linked to the history of the people. Language is one of the factors. But don't forget also that you look at the legal and the educational system, and you look at the culture of the people. So it's a combination of many things. But it boils down to marginalization. It boils down to the fact that 56 years after independence, that the terms of agreements were not really respected, and that the people of Southern Cameroons who joined the East Cameroonians in forming the union feel that they are considered as second-class fiddle in the relationship and feel that there's a lot of oppression, suppression, and marginalization.
Well, give me an example of a situation where one of the English speakers, for example, feels marginalized in Cameroon.
If you look at the recent entrance into the medical college in Cameroon, the two English universities of Boya and Bamenda, they don't have a pharmacy department. They don't do pharmacy in these universities. So if you want to study pharmacy, you have to go to the other universities, which are predominantly French. So it makes it difficult for the Anglophones, for the Southern Cameroonians, to be able to study successfully in that university and in most of the professional schools. The language of instructions in the professional schools is French. The Anglophones would have to struggle. These and many others. If you come to the services, even in the English-speaking part of the country, you have offices, you have judges, you have state councils, you have prosecutors who don't understand English language.
Well, but it's maybe not so surprising because 80% of the country speaks French and only 20% speaks English. I mean,
No, I understand the fact that the Francophones are the majority. But when these two people came together, you know, they came together on the understanding that there would be mutual respect. Mm-hmm. But so on the understanding that during the West Cameroon days, we had a prime minister. We had a speaker in the parliament. I'm not saying that we should have the same number of ministers. Like, no, because now we are not looking at the population. We are looking at the fact that these were two peoples that came together.
Right.
The Southern Cameroonians and the East Cameroonians. So if a president is from East Cameroon, the next in command should be from Southern Cameroon.
So do you think that one possible solution to this is that you just form an independent state for the Anglophones?
Well, you see, it could be. We have three different groupings in Anglophone Cameroon. There are those who still believe in the unitary state, the unitary decentralization. I think very, very few. There are those who are more centric, who believe in a two-state federation, others believe in a 10-state, and those who believe that there should be outright independence. And I think all the groupings have their arguments, which I personally respect them, you know. But we need to find a way out, especially even from an Anglophone perspective, to have a common position and a common voice. Federalism, a two-state federation, could be, and I say could be, a panacea. It could bring in the best in the French and the English system to build a country that would be based on equality, would be based on fairness, would be represent the wish of the aspirations of both people.
So we've seen these recent headlines of killings, burning of villages, attacks on government officials, and massive arrests. Are you worried that Cameroon could become the next Rwanda, that it could escalate into a civil war?
I'm extremely worried. You know, for somebody who has worked in the UN, in conflict zones like Sierra Leone, Afghanistan, and in the Democratic Republic of Congo, it is something very worrisome. I say we are sliding into a civil war. Some of my friends have already argued that we are already having a civil war. The suffering that is going on, look at the internally displaced, about 200,000. Look at the refugees, about 50,000. If all of us can just sit for a moment, think, and try to see how we can talk to each other, not talking across each other, not blaming each other, but trying to work towards a veritable dialogue and a solution, we might avert the mayhem.
I just want to ask you one more thing, because some of these protests have ended up becoming violent, and there's been reports that government authorities have shot back at the protesters. People have been killed. Do you denounce the violence on the Anglophone side?
Yes. As the founder and the chairman of the Center for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa, we have consistently denounce violence committed by both parties. We have consistently denounced kidnapping. We've consistently denounced the asking of ransom, the destruction of schools, the beheading of military officers. We have denounced violence committed by both parties. But you ask yourself a question. These were peaceful protesters. Who started the violence? You know, in 2016, we were just protesting. The government arrested us. The government spread tear gas, wounded them, imprisoned them for long, giving them 10 to 15 years sentences. Some of the arms groups, when you talk to them, their argument is that it's kind of self-defense. It might not be justifiable in the eyes of the law, but it's an argument that if you are on the ground and if you are in a village where the military forces come there, arrest your people, arrest your children, shoot them when they are unarmed, then you start rethinking, what can we do to protect ourselves from the recklessness done by the military?
That's Agbo Kongo, who is a human rights lawyer and current executive director of the NGO Center for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa, talking with us about the situation in Cameroon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. The pleasure is all mine.
Well, now to the St. Paul raccoon. Ben Johnson saw him outside his office window. Then Paige Law tweeted out, "He's on the ledge outside our office now. Seems to be doing well." Followed by @SarahLouise, "I'm not crying, you're crying." All of social media seemed to be crying out as the raccoon scaled the 25-story UBS skyscraper in St. Paul yesterday. Tim Nelson of Minnesota Public Radio used the hashtag MPRRaccoon. We'll link you at hearnow.org. But Tim, you're reporting he made it to the top and the trap set by specialist. You got to see him. How's he doing?
It's a she, actually. Oh. It's they think it's about a 1 to maybe 2-year-old small female. She was up there. We found her in the cage. She was very docile and quiet when we got there and very much enjoyed a can of cat food that they brought up as kind of a peace offering.
Okay, so it's Wonder Woman, not Spider-Man,
as
everyone was saying. But how nerve-wracking was this? She started on the town square building, crossed over to the UBS building. You were watching overnight. How nerve-wracking.
It was terrifying. I watched her go up the first 12 floors. I've never seen anything like this. I've lived in Minnesota around raccoons for half a century. I've never seen anything like this. And it was just, I was watching through my fingers. One wrong step and you're going to plummet to your death.
I know. And meanwhile, firefighters showed up. There was nothing they could do. It was too dangerous. A maintenance crew tried. They couldn't do it. The windows don't open, you know, so nobody on the floors could do it. So just nerve-wracking. And we understand that raccoons can do this because they have these claws. And there was probably just, not suction cups, but claws that got into little crevices. But why was she doing this?
When I talk to wildlife specialists, they say that the natural reaction of a raccoon when they're frightened is to climb. And so probably the initial effort to rescue her near the ground probably frightened her quite a bit. And then a very large crowd gathered on the street below. And that probably just kept driving her up and up and up. And she hoped to get away.
Well, they could have formed a human, you know, web to catch her if something had happened. But just why do you think it is? She's going to go to someplace safe. But why do you think it is that this captivated so many people on a day when two world leaders are meeting in Singapore?
Well, you know, these are very complex and difficult times, and I think this is something that no matter who you are, no matter what your political leanings, you could root for her to make it to the top, to arrive safely.
No kidding. Tim Nelson of Minnesota Public Radio. Again, we'll link you up at hearnow.org. Tim, thank you.
You're welcome.
From today, that huge merger between AT&T and Time Warner will be complete. That's according to an AT&T attorney who spoke after a federal judge ruled yesterday that AT&T can move forward with its $85 billion acquisition of Time Warner. And that decision is expected to give ammunition to a number of other mergers in the U.S., from Sprint and T-Mobile to even the CVS Aetna deal. Robin Farzad hosts the podcast Full Disclosure and joins us now to talk more about this. Hi, Robin.
Good, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. So AT&T, with this merger, is now going to own HBO, CNN, the Harry Potter franchise. What are the implications of this? How is it going to remake the media landscape?
Wait, don't forget, it's also AT&T is going to own Cinemax. So
You can't forget about Cinemax.
This is one of those giant gambles on distribution. I mean, Jeremy, in this case, a giant wireless network itself, a product of many mega mergers fusing with mega content. So Ma Bell and taking out HBO and Time Warner, it's really one of the crown jewels of premium content. Game of Thrones, The Sopranos, and all that other stuff on the cable dial, TBS, TNT, lots of sports.
Right. And I have to say, as a customer of both a cell phone provider, not AT&T, but a cell phone provider and a cable company, I pay for both of them right now. Is it possible that with these mergers, I'm only going to have to pay for one?
It's probable. I think it's certainly one of the mega trends that media watchers believes finally going to get spawned out of this. The idea that it's not just enough to have voice and internet and cable. You ideally want wireless and a rich library of content included on one bill, because that old cable bundle that, you know, people are cutting the cord wire cutters are out there and they're paying for Spotify and Netflix separately. And this has the enormous incumbents terrified.
Talk about the politics of this merger. The Department of Justice had sued to block the deal. President Trump had said the deal was not good for the country. And yet, here we are.
Oh, I don't think Donald Trump takes this stuff personally. I mean, not Time Warner owning CNN, which he loves. And think about John Oliver on HBO. And isn't Samantha Bee on TBS? Look, and that's why it's so disappointing for them that they did it under the cloak, under the patina of, like, we're protecting the consumer. And the judge just kind of came out and gave it the all clear.
Well, why did that happen, do you think?
Because everything has changed in this category right now. I mean, whoever thought that Amazon would be a giant player in media? It's not just the cable companies owning the fat pipes or the wireless companies owning the pipes. There are ways of getting past the traditional gatekeepers now that completely put this in play. And we're talking – I mean, Ma Bell was broken up when? In 1983, 1984. And now Ma Bell is reconstituting itself around content and a super fat bill.
What other companies are watching this merger?
I just think if you look at the street today, every single company in media is watching closely and having their bankers on overtime. If you look at the wireless also-rans, T-Mobile and Sprint, I mean, they're focused on shacking up in order to spend on the next generation networks that can compete with something like unlimited HBO streaming on an AT&T plan. Verizon is watching closely. You have Pure Play Media. I mean, what happens to Showtime or the strange confederation behind Hulu, which I never understood? I mean, Comcast and Disney, they're duking it out for Fox assets. And Disney is already busy trying to wall off its library from Netflix, which suddenly, if you look at its value today, is worth $165 billion. And then, Jeremy, you think about all the other cable providers and unaffiliated channels. Where do they go? How does Amazon streaming, for example, respond?
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Verizon. The CEO there actually said that buying a pay TV company is not their strategy. And the new CEO coming in is actually the current CTO, the technical officer, which suggests to some that Verizon may be more interested in focusing on upgrading its technology to 5G than acquiring a content creator.
Yeah, I'm not hearing that now. I mean, they've always charged a premium to other wireless carriers on the strength of their networks. I mean, but what happens when their subscribers start whining about AT&T throwing in HBO for free or, say, another player bundling Netflix? T-Mobile even had a promotion in the spring that included a year of streaming MLB TV. I'm really curious to see how the other pro leagues respond. It's not just going to be enough to say our network is excellent. People are going to want all of this stuff packaged. The subscriber really wants you to nibble on his ear.
And even outside of media, we mentioned CVS and Aetna. The shares of CVS Health jumped today. What are we going to see in terms of mergers all across the board?
Well, the first quarter of this year was tops in history for global mergers and acquisitions. And a lot of that was prodded by record markets and all that cash unleashed by Trump's tax reforms. Wall Street today is just abuzz with this idea that this administration is going to think twice about opposing other mega mergers after this very emphatic AT&T decision. So read into it what you will.
Don't they always say that the mergers and acquisitions peak right before the markets start to go down? Everybody wants to sell high.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for a shoe shine to recommend a stock or something. Get one of those other signals for me to kind of liquidate my brokerage account. But I'm not sure we're there yet.
Do you think, Robin, final word here, that this is good for consumers or bad for consumers?
I think it's great because you are going to see a bigger bundle. And I don't think that people are necessarily comfortable paying $300 or $400 on a bundle if you have that quintuple play. They're going to demand more. They're going to demand perks. You're going to see people calling into Verizon and demanding retention. What are you going to give me? Well, I got to spend another $20 for this streaming thing. You're not bundling. It's going to cause a whole new wave of consolidation.
It's Robin Farzad, who hosts the podcast Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, all nonprofits there. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here Now.